Welcome to the Aspiring Mormon Woman Podcast. Aspiring Mormon Woman is a nonprofit dedicated to supporting the educational and professional goals of LDS women. You can find us at aspiringmormonwoman.org or on Facebook.
We're here tonight to talk about the Modern Mormon Men post that was published this week that was entitled, Are Mormon Men Unintentionally Discriminating at Work? And this article really provided a pretty robust discussion in our Aspiring Mormon Women discussion forum. And so we decided to have a bigger, well, not bigger because there's only three of us now, but a more in-depth conversation about this article and kind of our thoughts about it. And so tonight we have, oh, by the way, I'm Naomi. And we have Ryan Hammond, who I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves, and Julianne Gray. So, Ryan, do you want to tell a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm Ryan. I am one of the, I don't know, a board member at Aspiring Mormon Women. Sure. Hang out with Naomi. Relevant to this discussion, I have both a master's and a PhD in things like human resource management and the sociology of work and labor markets. So I can provide some of that perspective.
And Julianne.
Hi, I'm Julianne Gray, and I'm excited to be able to contribute to this discussion. I have a MBA from Brigham Young University and have spent 5 years working for a major retailer in marketing, and then recently took a job actually working for BYU doing recruiting for one of the graduate programs there. And so I hope to be able to bring the perspective of having kind of had that corporate experience to the discussion.
And for any modern Mormon men listening to this, Julianne's a good person to know since she like controls your destiny.
If you're trying to get into the BYU grad program. BYU MBA program, yes.
Yes. So.
And then, you know, and I'm Naomi, and I'm a co-founder of Aspiring Mormon Women and have a PhD in education, so a pretty female-dominated field. And the Modern Mormon Men post that Alex Fuller wrote talked about his kind of aha moment in a seminar about thinking about how he interacts with females in the workplace and realizing that he seems to treat his female coworkers differently than his male coworkers. I don't know if you guys want to add anything about that post.
So I will say as a, until recently, MBA professor, I was really happy to see education doing its work, right? Having those types of aha moments is what going to MBA and business school and getting education is for. So kudos to the seminar, the people who ran the seminar, and I think kudos to Alex for, you know, getting something so important out of it.
And this is Julianne. Just to add to that, one of the things was it kind of rang true from my corporate experience, some of the things that I've seen. And so, again, I applaud Alex for being able to kind of have that epiphany and recognize that, you know, maybe there is some improvement, not only on, you know, his part, but also the people around him, and to try to do what he can to improve.
Well, and his post really in our AMW discussion forum led to a lot of Mormon women sharing personal experiences of working with other Mormon men in the workplace and how many of their like interactions are very different with their Mormon male colleagues than with their non-Mormon male colleagues. And since I work in a female-dominated profession, I don't have very many Mormon male colleagues, period. And the ones that I do have, I've never had any weirdness with. But Julianne, I know you had some experiences personally that you might want to talk about.
Yeah, so when I was in business school at BYU, most of your work is done in groups. That's just how the program is set up. And when you're assigned a group, especially that first semester, you don't get to choose who's in your group. And one of my male group members refused to be alone with me, even at a table out in the main atrium of the Tanner building. And if you aren't familiar with that building, it's very open, large, big, loud. I mean, there isn't a more, you know, aside from maybe being out on the quad, like there's not a more public place that you can be. And so if the rest of the group left early, he would leave too, even if there was more work to be done. And so, you know, there was times where that was detrimental to our schoolwork. And, you know, it also made me feel, you know, uncomfortable just because, you know, it felt like I was doing something wrong, even though I wasn't, I was just being a student. So, you know, now that I work for the Merritt School, that's something that, you know, the powers that be are aware of, that sometimes this happens and that it can be career limiting for people who sometimes have these, you know, feelings and are uncomfortable in those situations. And they're actively working to educate students on how to be able to navigate these situations. I do have a positive ending to that story in that by the end of the semester, once my group member actually got to know me as a person, instead of, you know, as a label or as like a woman who is a threat to his marriage, he had no issues studying with me and, you know, we're friends to this day. But, you know, he had to really get past, you know, and we'll talk about this, I think, later, you know, that counsel that he got when he got married, which was never be alone with another woman ever in your life that you're not married to, you know, now that you're mm-hmm. married. And he had to really, you know, work to move past that. So,
yeah, and you know, I'll add just, you know, being in the professoriate circles, you know, I know BYU professors that every once in a while this happens, right? Like some guy comes in and says, I can't be in this group, you know, because of this reason, like, or I can't be a partner with this person on a, you know, with this woman on a project because, well, I'm married and that would be inappropriate. And, you know, my understanding is that, like, when this happens, they just sit the guy down at this point and say, like, look, you got to get over it, you know, like, and they do, and, you know, because they know that just does not work in the work world anymore, to do that. And even, I think even for many of them, it's not even about that. It's about even if that worked out in the world where you went into, they know that it's inappropriate and they're very aware about how limiting that can actually, the impacts of it on the women students, on the female students in the program. And I think they care a lot. So I think even, you know, in what we might consider the bastion of kind of like Mormon work culture, if you would, this is, like you say, it's a problem they're aware of. And they're aware of it not only from the guy's side, but like also because they understand that they have a responsibility to making sure that the women's experience is as inclusive and good as it should be.
And to just add on to that, you know, I definitely want to point out that this, you know, was a very isolated case. I'm not going to say that it probably doesn't happen, but, you know, on the flip side, I had many male friends in business school who were enlightened and had no issue with being in a group with me or going to lunch with me. There was one specific friend that he and I would go to lunch all the time. And, you know, we talked about it, frankly, you know, to say, hey, you know, does this, you know, we went to lunch enough that we felt like, hey, is this weird? You know, are we crossing a line? And we really talked about it and decided that we weren't crossing a line, especially if he always felt like he could talk to his wife about the fact that I went to lunch with Julianne today. You know, if it ever became something that he felt like he had to hide or keep from his wife, that maybe that would mean that something in our, you know, relationship or friendship had changed enough that maybe we had crossed a line. But it never, ever went into that territory. We're still very good friends to this day. And he's a great colleague that I, you know, appreciate his perspective, you know, even today when I, you know, need, you know, his perspective on things. I also want to point out, too, that one of my very best mentors at my previous job was a non-LDS male. He was my former boss, and he was a huge advocate for me. He helped me get promoted several times, helped me receive some really good assignments at work, and I would not have received those assignments without him being an advocate for me in those, you know, meetings with higher-ups. And we traveled for work together alone. We met in his office alone. And there was never, ever any sense of impropriety. It simply didn't come up. It was never an issue. It was never awkward. I traveled many times for work in my last job with male travel partners, and it was never, ever discussed because it was such a non-issue. And the way I think about, you know, not only my business school friends, but also, you know, the male friends from and colleagues from my previous job is I think about them as brothers. I mean, that's how I treat them, is like brothers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it never ever ventured into sexual territory or ever crossed a line where it was anything but, you know, a friendship. So anyway, well, that's what I experienced.
And to piggyback off that, Julianne, like, I don't think I've ever had an explicit conversation with a male colleague about whether or not us meeting together is appropriate or not. You know, like, and that's just not something that's ever arisen with, especially with my non-LDS male colleagues that I have. But, I mean, even one of my best friends from graduate school is an LDS male, and we have written together and done all kinds of things professionally together, and there's never been anything that is weird. You know, he's totally treated me as a person. So we definitely don't want to get the idea that, oh, all LDS men do this, because that's not true. I mean, there are definitely isolated stories, but it also is an issue.
Well, and I think one of the things that Alex's post was a little bit about, and this space is important, is it is really trying to understand the scale of these problems, right? Because, I mean, let's admit it, like, if a bad thing happens, if an affair happens or an inappropriate relationship happens, it has pretty big consequences.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually pretty rare to have happen, especially anything that, you know, is very, very bad. And I think we just have to keep in mind that, like, it really is the exceptions. And the question is should we have these really broad cultural rules for what are really tend to be isolated, very individual cases? And I think this might be getting on to a little bit of what we were discussing, is that, you know, there are some policies or some practices inside, you know, the church realm that we do have these kind of broad policies about, like your mission rules, for example. And it seems that a lot of what's going on is people interpolating those back into this professional workspace, like trying to carry them over. And it's very, very unclear that they fit.
Well, and I mean, Julianne talked too about how without those male colleagues and those male mentors, like, she would not have been able to progress in her career, right? And taking that a step further too, like, aspiring more women would not even exist without the relationship that Ryan and I have. Like, right. And, you know,
Naomi, are you saying that aspiring Mormon women is our baby?
Yes. And Diane. So it's like this weird.
Oh, wow. That's even way weirder.
Yes,
okay.
Way weirder. But I mean, it's a result of this, like, of men and women collaborating together, right? And that's powerful, I think. You know, this idea that we only can work within our gender because, oh, there might be something horrible that happens. I think we're really missing out on a lot of great opportunity.
You know, I was attending a panel focused on, you know, women's issues and gender issues a few weeks ago, sponsored by Goldman Sachs in downtown Salt Lake, and they had four different women who were on the panel, and one of them was Sherry Dew, who, mm-hmm. you know, has been a leader in our church, but has also been a CEO of Deseret Book and has done a lot of great things professionally. But one of the things she talked about that I thought was super interesting was she said, whenever I've had a big problem at work, it's because I had all women working on it or I had all men working on it. She goes, there is a great partnership that can happen when men and women are working together. Because she goes, she recognized she was making kind of a broad generalization. She goes, men and women approach things differently. And when you have those two different perspectives working on something together, that's where really great work comes. And so anyway, I thought that was super interesting that she, you know, specifically called out that, right. that need for that collaboration, both male and female together.
So we've kind of talked about this a little bit already about, like, why this, you know, this type of thinking is problematic. And it's particularly, like, Ryan made a really good point, in the discussion forum, or I think even on a comment about, the title, about how Mormon men are unintentionally discriminating at work. So do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more, Ryan?
Well, so I think, so in the post, and I guess we haven't specifically talked exactly about what the post said, and we'll link to it, of course, so you can go read it, is the author had pointed out two different things that he had noticed. One was about how he found himself just naturally talking to men more than women, say in a church context, or even in a work context. And he realized how imbalanced that was. And he's like, wow, where does that behavior come from? But the other thing he mentioned were these ones that we're talking about, which is, I have this explicit fidelity rule in my head that says I can't be alone with a woman for this very explicit reason. And one of the things I pointed out is that the first case, just like having what we would call homophily inside of, from a sociological perspective, it being easier, you're more prone to talk to people like yourself, same gender, same whatever, that can actually be unintentional. But when you're actually making intentional rules for yourself about, I will never go to lunch with a woman colleague, I don't think it's fair to call that unintentional discrimination.
Right.
It's very intentional.
Right.
Now, it's very intentional, and you're marginalizing in a very intentional way, even if you didn't, maybe you didn't intentionally think that that's what you were doing. So I think that's important, is just to think about those cases separately. One, when you're doing it on purpose for some logic, and we can talk about how problematic that is. But there are also something I think we should talk about, which is all the truly unintentional, unconscious ways that we can potentially marginalize, say, women in the workplace, especially as LDS guys. For me, I think it's important to say that these exceptional cases that we're talking about mm-hmm. are not good grounds for making broad rules that lead to the systematic marginalization of women at work. And I think that's the real problem, mm-hmm. is that, and maybe the unintentional consequence Alex was talking about was, I make this rule for this very good reason, it's about fidelity, but the consequence of that rule is a systematic marginalization of women inside the workplace.
Right.
And that's not okay. And I think one thing that I would say is that, because it's such an idiosyncratic, specific instance that someone is worried about, that it does not justify broad cultural rules applied to everyone.
Well, we're also not saying that there shouldn't be any boundaries at work, right? I mean, it is a workplace. It's a professional setting. It's not your living room or a bar, right? So instead of making boundaries about all women are this and all men are this, it really is more about the types of conversations and those interactions that you have, right, with people at work, opposite sex or not, right? It's not the fact that you're having this one-on-one business meeting, or you're having coffee, or I guess hot chocolate, or your Diet Coke or whatever, or lunch with someone. It's more about what are you talking about in these, during these conversations. So for example, this isn't an example of a male colleague, but there was a female coworker who talked a lot about her sex life at work, and that was inappropriate. I mean, that's not an appropriate conversation regardless of the gender of who else is in that group. Right. So, thinking about boundaries in that way, as opposed to just completely discriminating against a group. Right.
Yeah. Well, I love this image, right, of some man and woman sitting across the desk, looking at an Excel spreadsheet, right. And talking about the marketing numbers. And then they look up at each other and are just let's get it on right now, right? I mean, that just does not happen.
Well,
you don't go from we have this relationship over the quarterly marketing numbers that we have to discuss every quarter to, let's have an affair. There's so many stages that have to happen. So many other boundaries have to be crossed before you even get close. You have so many other chances to set appropriate boundaries. Does anybody have that model in their head?
Grey's Anatomy.
Okay, maybe people need to watch less Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, Shonda Rhimes. If Shonda Rhimes is writing, creating your work environment, then totally that happens all the time.
Maybe if you worked with McSteamy, huh?
Right, or Dreamy, or whatever he is. But now he's dead, so it doesn't matter.
And I think you guys make a really good point. I talked about the impact to my career that having a good relationship with my male, former boss, male colleague, way it helped my career and potentially how that could be limiting for my career if, you know, I didn't have those opportunities. But this kind of behavior can be detrimental and limiting to men's careers too. You know, I worked, as I mentioned, for a major retailer, and, you know, at a junior level, like, the fact is your boss is probably going to be a female, you know, and I guess that's, it can be industry, you know, specific or depend on the industry that you worked in, but you are most likely going to have coworkers who are female. And in my company, director level and below, 60% of our department was female. So if you couldn't have a boss that was female, or you couldn't work with people that were female, like, there was no way that you were going to be able to get your work done and be effective and be a good employee and be able to move up in your career. Like, that's just not a reality. So, and as I talked about before, you know, business schools, not only, you know, BYU, but other business schools are recognizing that, you know, women are a huge part of the workforce, and they're making an effort in their recruiting, you know, efforts to recruit more women into their business programs, because that's what companies are looking for. And so that's only going to increase, you know, going forward.
Yeah. And I mean, I even more than being industry specific, it's really occupation specific too, right? Like, there, and the number of occupations that are left that are, you know, fully male dominated, where you can have like an old boys club, is actually very small. I mean, they're out there. Some of them tend to be high status, but, you know, I worked in human resource management. That's a, you know, it's a female majority field at least. And so my first bosses were all women, and, you know, at least 50% of my peer colleagues, were women. And, you know, I don't know of any Mormon guy crazy enough to, like, go to his female boss and say, I'm sorry, I can't have a meeting alone with you because, like, I think it more happens on this peer interaction. But these days, your peer mentorship and your peer network is actually almost more important for your overall career mobility, especially your early career network. So, you know, I think, as you know, if I was advising any Mormon men about this, I would be like, you are going to really hurt yourself. And especially if you get pegged as the weird one, like, no one wants to be the weird one.
Well, no one wants to be with the weird one either.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and it will make the women uncomfortable around you to think,
yeah.
I mean, again, like, thinking about it from the flip side, you know, if a man came to me, and I guess it goes back to my experience of having that group member that was like, I can't be alone with you, you know, if I'm your boss, you tell me you can't be alone with me, like, I might be having a conversation with HR, you know?
Right.
So you can open up a whole different, you know, conversation, can of worms, whatever, you know, when you go down that road. And so it's just, you know, making sure you understand that, I mean, yes, everyone is free to make the decisions and set the boundaries that they feel like is right for their relationship or right for themselves, but, you know, there's some realities and implications that are going to be there, you know, and you should be aware of that.
Yeah. So, Ryan, as our token Mormon male.
Modern Mormon.
Modern. Man. Aspiring Mormon man. Can you kind of provide some insight maybe, or your thoughts as to why this seems to happen in the LDS culture versus not?
Well, So let me talk. I think we've covered the kind of fidelity rule type thing, and we could talk about, you know, some of the mission, like, you know, how you're trained as a missionary. We could talk about some of the institutional rules that are put in place for things like bishop or for certain priesthood offices. But I think the only comment I would make there is, you know, we have to understand that a lot of those rules are put in place largely for legal reasons in the church. You know, it's a very conservative legal approach because, you know, honestly, they're worried about the church having lots of money being sued for different things and for really bad PR things to happen. And so they put these rules in place inside of a church context, right? Like bishops not being alone in a building, for example, with a woman, you get very strong instructions about, you know, if you're in these priesthood leadership roles, you shouldn't be in a car alone with a woman. But, you know, I think too many people try to then, you know, port those into the workplace in a way that, in a context that's so different that it's just not appropriate. So I do think there's that. But I think, you know, more interesting to me is thinking about more of this unintentional way. Like, why is it that for some reason it seems like Mormon men are unintentionally marginalizing or not inclusive? And I think that's an more interesting discussion.
So one thing that I was also thinking about as we were having this discussion is about, like, there's a lot of sometimes fear, I think, in that, you know, if I do blank, then I'm going to suddenly sin, which we've talked about a little bit already. But two, there's not, I mean, the LDS culture kind of separate, not kind of, they do separate the boys from the girls after age 12, right, into young men's and young women's. And we're almost kind of taught to fear each other because in the sense that, you know, if you do something, if you get too close to one of them, you're going to totally slip up and get into trouble. And so because of that, we don't necessarily always learn to interact with the opposite sex in a really healthy way, right? Or we're taught that, like, that we're not supposed to have impure thoughts, that attraction is evil, even though the attraction itself isn't, it's acting on it that is problematic, right? So I have these impure thoughts. I feel sexually aroused when I see that member of the opposite sex, and therefore all members of the opposite sex are a danger to me. And so because of that, I'm not going to interact with them and never actually learn how to do so in a healthy way. And so really, instead, we should be talking about to our youth about how sexual attraction is this natural thing. But there are limits, obviously, right, that we shouldn't see the other person always as a potential mate. We shouldn't always have just dating relationships and with our youth between girls and boys. But I know, Ryan, you had a different experience in young men's and women's.
Yeah, well, when we were talking about this before, I was going to say that I thought one of the most positive parts of my upbringing in the church, to be honest, and I think my wife would say the same thing about this, is that I felt that, like, young men and young women gave me a lot of chances to interact with women in ways that were, you know, based in friendship, you know, in normal environments. We weren't all dating each other. Right. You know, we were friends. And I thought that it actually gave me a really good platform to learn, learn to interact with women as people first. Right. And as dating targets second. You know, the irony being, of course, that, you know, my wife and I were in the same stake and we ended up getting married. But we actually never dated in high school. You know, we were friends. And so I felt like and maybe part of that's been lost. You know, I think maybe how we grew up in the, for me, it was like the early 90s. Like, I think I do have some sense that some of this rhetoric maybe has gotten dysfunctional in some areas, in some wards. And there's been a lot of discussion about that in the Bloggernacle generally. Yeah, and that's true. So I guess people who are going to their MBA programs now maybe grew up in a more polarized environment that way. But for me, I thought that was a very positive part of my experience.
Well, and I think for me, most of my most positive experiences, like non-romantic relationships with men in my teens, really came outside of church. So, like, I was involved in competitive swimming and, you know, there we are all are in our bathing suits, practically naked, you know, all every day, boys and girls, and we managed just to be friends, right? We had like very platonic conversations standing in her bathing suits.
Not possible.
I know, it's amazing. but I mean that's how I interacted with with boys at my age. I wasn't really interested in dating at that point either. But when it came to church, like, suddenly it was a different experience for me. So that is kind of an interesting hearing your take on that.
Julianne, what was your experience like?
I don't know that it was super polarizing, but I also don't know that it was, super you know, interactive. I mean, I'm trying to think of some specific examples, but I do remember feeling like, you know, of course you wanted to interact more with the boys so you could, you know, get to know them better. And there was like literally one activity every month that was the, you know, young men, young women combined activity that we would all look forward to.
And the boys would want to play basketball.
Yeah, right.
Okay, guilty.
You know, and there was a, you know, a couple of war dances, you know, that kind of stuff. But I do feel like that that we were pretty separated, you know, that the girls did their thing and the boys did their thing. And, you know, it was really only at that one activity every month that we got to really see each other. And so it kind of created this idea that, you know, we didn't really get to learn how to
work with each other.
Yeah, and be, you know, friends, you know, that it was always like, oh, we get to see the boys, you know. And so it was this kind of immature thing. We never got to the mature level of being able to just be cool with each other and be friends. Now, that's not to say that at school I didn't have guy friends or whatever, but, you know, I don't know that my young men, young women experience was super negative, but I don't know that it was super overly positive in that way either. So...
Well, and I would say if I think about, I think where any kind of weirdness, like, came for me, it's like there does seem to be this shift, like, when you get married, right? And you go to these married wards. And all of a sudden you go from being, like, yourself, you know, just like yourself or whoever, to, like, being a couple. And there is when I started to feel like there were these more tacit pressures for, like, you know, do I, you know, can I have friends that are girls that are married to my other friend that are boys, right? Like, can I have a separate friendship with them or a friendship with them that's separate from my relationship with the guy in some way? And I think that's a little, I mean, I think we were lucky. I think, again, I think my wife and I were lucky that, you know, in our early college married life, we had a lot of, you know, couple friends, and I kind of felt that we were pretty good friends across gender boundaries with our couple, you know, with our couple friends. But I don't know. If any weirdness entered for me, that's kind of when it entered.
Well, and I'll say too, like, I was single until I was 33. So I think probably where I learned to have, like, healthy male-female relationships was in all my single years, because I had a lot of opportunities to serve, not as part of a couple, you know, with men, with women, where, we were able to be, you know, friends, both, you know, potential dating partners and not potential dating partners. So, I think that's where I learned how to have those, you know, more healthy, platonic relationships, was after I was out of high school and out of young men, young women. And not before.
We've been talking about how, like, young men, young women are separate, and how, like, well, at least for Julianne and I, not a lot of integration. And we see this happen even, you know, as adults, right? That a lot of the presidencies are same gender. Like, you really say president, all women, you know, elders quorum, all men. And sometimes we see it happen in Sunday school presidencies where, like, the secretary is a woman. So really, like, outside of, like, a ward council, men and women don't really have a lot of time or chances to work together in presidencies, right? That, so this continues, right? Where that this isn't happening.
And even a ward council, you have, like, 15 people in the room or something. So,
right.
You know, you're not working one-on-one or one-on-two or three. You know, in a small group, you're working as part of a bigger group, which always seems to make people...
Yeah.
Feel more
and I think, I mean, we just have to recognize that in a work context these days, like, that's actually the exception, right? Like, you go to a meeting every once in a while, but a lot of the real tactical work gets done in pairs, in very small teams, right? Like, I mean, you know, I would say the vast majority of the interactions you have with people are, you know, one-on-one meetings with people to work on something, to, you know, do some work process, to, you know, work on a presentation together, to work on a project together, because, you know, usually firms don't have a lot of incentive to put more people on a task than necessary.
Well, and even,
right?
At,
like,
conferences,
to make big groups,
right? Yeah. At conferences, I find that the most valuable part of a conference is not the sessions I attend, but the conversations I have outside of those conferences, of those sessions, the networking, the dinners I attend, the one-on-one conversations I have with people in the hallway. It's not sitting in one of those big rooms, right? So, yeah. And most meetings, and most big meetings are not useful.
Yeah, and I was going to say, for when you think about developing your professional network over time, real trust relationships, you know, you can't just have a real trust relationship with like, oh, I've seen this person in some big meetings and they're pretty good. Like usually your networks, the real valuable relationships you make in the network are built on one-on-one interactions. Like that's how you gain trust. That's how you, you know, gain connection. It can't just be in this broad thing.
That's how you get to know that that's somebody that you'll vouch for them. You know, don't vouch for someone that you heard speak at a conference. You'd be like, yeah, their speech was really good. But the people that you're going to advocate for, or the people that you're willing to stake your professional reputation on, are people that you've worked directly with or for, or, you know, whatever. So, I mean, that's how you build that, you know, credibility that you're going to be able to hopefully use later, is by that one-to-one or one-on-two small group interaction.
Yep, absolutely.
So one of the reasons why Aspiring Mormon Women even exists in the first place is to provide, you know, Mormon women with the opportunity to professionalize themselves, right? Because, and we've talked about this in other areas before, but that as Mormon women, we're often not seen as people who should be in the workplace in the first place, right? We're supposed to all be home with oodles and oodles of kids, and I'm failing. But so we don't really teach that women are or can be professionals, and I'm wondering if that could possibly be, you know, contributing to this problem too. What do you think, Ryan?
So if there is one academic study that I would give to every single modern Mormon man, it's actually a new study that came out in a very good journal called Administrative Science Quarterly, and I just brought it up. One of the authors is actually at the University of Utah, but it's Desai, Chu, and Brief, if you remember Brief, B-R-I-E-F. And they had this incredibly well done study. It's got three different types of studies in it: an experimental study, a longitudinal field study, and another one in there. And what they show is something really, really interesting, which is that a lot of discriminatory attitudes towards women, like the subconscious kind that you don't really think about, like, do I consider women as competent as men? For example, you know, like, would I rate them as the same competency if I had a, you know, experimentally manipulated situation? They found that it wasn't being male made you more likely to, but they found that men that have stay-at-home wives actually are the ones that showed so many of these discriminatory attitudes or behaviors, these unconscious ones. And what's even more interesting is they actually show with the longitudinal study that as men's wives move in and out of the workforce, that the men's attitudes change. It's really, really fascinating. And, you know, for many of us, and this includes me, you know, my wife has been home with our children for most of our marriage. You know, we're in the situation where many of us have stay-at-home wives. And it turns out that puts us at risk for some reason of having these discriminatory attitudes towards women. And I mean, wow, it's a really, really good study. You should go read it. It's like 2014.
Well, maybe we can put a link to it.
Yeah, I'll put a link to it. But like, really, I think this goes to Alex's point about unintentional as opposed to intentional, is I think most of this is not intentional at all. I think it's mostly unintentional, but just, you know, for some reason, having your wife stay at home, for whatever reason that you do that, puts you at risk of having these discriminatory behaviors, not seeing women as being as competent, even if they're doing the same job, you know, paying them less, you know, all this type of stuff seems to be related to that. And I think a lot of Mormon men need to be aware of it.
So we've talked about, you know, why we think this is a problem, you know, what happens to men and women with this continue. So really kind of the bottom line is, like, what can LDS men do? Like, what can they do to kind of combat this, to kind of answer Alex's question in his blog post? So what do you think, Julianne?
Yeah, so I think it's really great. We've talked a lot about all these things that are maybe wrong or right or whatever, but, you know, I think it's always good when there's problems to then come with solutions. And so hopefully we can share some ideas that we've thought of, and hopefully that will be some thought starters for other things. But one of the things we talked about was that, yes, absolutely, we should be setting appropriate boundaries, but make sure that they're manageable. You know, we talked about how there's a lot of implications that can come from setting wide, crazy, huge boundaries that maybe aren't necessary. And so finding that right balance of what's the appropriate boundary, and then making them manageable. And, you know, we've talked about it already, but there are so many things that have to happen between a friendship or having a, you know, one-on-one meeting with your boss, and all the way up to, you know, actually having an affair. And so there's plenty of time to get off that road if the situation arises. Affairs don't just happen. We kind of already gave the joke of, like, oh, we're looking at, you know, the quarterly results, and then suddenly we make eye contact and, you know, we're having an affair, and that only happens on Grey's Anatomy.
Yes.
It only happens in TV or the movies or whatever. You know, that there are a lot of things that have to happen in between there. And so being vigilant, but, you know, being self-aware along that process, that you don't have to set a boundary of, I'm not going to talk to any women because I might have an affair, that maybe, you know, maybe you can bring that boundary in a little bit closer to, you know, I'm not going to go into a woman's hotel room, you know, when we're traveling alone. You know, that maybe that's a more appropriate boundary rather than, I'm never going to go on a business trip with a female coworker ever. You know?
One thing that I would say is, you know, one of the first steps to this is awareness, which is one reason that I really liked Alex's post, right? Is he was willing to say, I've had this aha experience. But I think if I start to counsel Mormon men about this, the first thing to do is to accept that, like all guys, not just LDS guys, but like all guys, you know, we have these blind spots. We're not naturally good at this. And I would say that, you know, LDS men have a particular extra challenges to overcome often in doing this, like, because of the ones that we expect. And so just the first step is to accept that you need to be very thoughtful and careful. And I get most worried about the guys who don't think they have a problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, who think, like, oh no, this doesn't apply to me.
I would never treat women differently.
Yeah. I never treat them differently.
Never.
Right?
Ever.
Yeah. Never.
and you know, but we all have biases. Like, it's part of yeah. being human. Right. So.
Yeah. And this is just one that I think we as LDS men need to be particularly aware of, because we're particularly prone to it. And, you know, and one thing that I would say, like, if I was talking directly to Alex, for example, you know, one thing I would say is, and this is from my own experience, right, is, like, you have this aha moment, and then all of a sudden you start seeing it, right? You're like, oh my gosh, I see how I'm treating this different. I'm seeing how I'm not including, you know, women. I'm going to fix that. And once you see it, you can't unsee it, which is good. But then I personally then got into a point where I'm like, oh, I see it. I'm in the club. Like, now I see it. I've covered all my blind spots. Like, I've moved the mirror. You know, I've got the special mirror that means I have no blind spots. And that's just not true, right? Then I just stepped in it a couple more times, and I'm like, oh, I'm never going to not have blind spots in this area.
I call Ryan out on his blind spots all the time.
I think we all need someone like that in our lives to help us recognize.
Yeah, no, and you should, right? Like, we should.
Well, and vice versa.
And so, yeah, and yeah. And so that's what I would say is like, be aware of it, and be aware that even when you are aware, it's still not over. And the last thing I would say is please listen to the experiences of LDS women when they talk to you and don't discount them. Like, you need to have conversations with the Naomis of the world and be very gracious when they say, you know, you talk too much. And at that point, I'll stop talking.
I think it's a great point that, you know, we all have our own weaknesses, we all have our own biases, and we need people to help us recognize those. So I think it's really important for each person to be responsible for owning their own specific challenges or weaknesses and then setting boundaries accordingly. So, you know, for example, and I think I included this on one of my posts in the forum, which was, you know, someone who's in recovery for alcoholism, maybe, you know, they are going to have to set a boundary that they don't go to any work functions at a bar. Like, they're, you know, they just aren't willing to accept those consequences. But, you know, that doesn't mean that every person in the entire church needs to not ever go into a bar ever just because that one person, you know, set that specific boundary based on their experiences. So I think we need to be self-aware enough to recognize what's a challenge for us, what's a weakness for us, set our boundaries, and, you know, specific counsel for one individual or, you know, your personal individual boundaries determined by yourself or you as a couple with your spouse, you know, that's not necessarily broadly applicable to everyone. So I think we need to have that personal self-assessment and then make sure we keep it personal instead of saying, well, everyone needs to do that as well.
Well, and to move to a different kind of solution, right, is back to that conversation about the segregation of the sexes at church and how often, too, a lot of times the conversations at church tend to be men to men in the hallways and women to women in the hallways. Or when people are meeting a couple, for example, the woman is never asked if she works herself. Just assume that she's not. My suggestion would be really that as people at church, we should more actively integrate at church, right? We should make it a point for men and women to talk about what they're doing at school, if they're in school, or what they're doing at work, right? Not just making assumptions based on gender that, you know, they must not be doing blank or they are doing blank because they're a man or a woman.
Well, and let me just add to that too, that I think as like men in the church, like this assumption that you meet someone and, you know, she's a woman and she is staying home with kids or whatever, that somehow you don't have anything in common or there's not a reason to like actually develop a friendship with that person is like really blindsided, right? Like, I mean, regardless of your work situation, everyone has interesting things they're doing. They, you know,
and they're multifaceted. We just aren't
our working roles or, you know, what we do, right? Like, you know, I still have very, very good friends from my college, you know, my college days, you know, that are women that, you know, are at home with, you know, that are primarily at home with kids. And you know what? They're still really interesting people. They really are. There's no reason not to include them in conversations in the hallway or, you know, to develop appropriate friendships. Like, that's just really sad, right?
Right.
So maybe one of the things that can help with that is, you know, using the fact that you guys had, using the example of the fact that you had such positive experiences during that, those kind of formative years when you're kind of learning to navigate those situations with male-female interaction, like consistent joint activity planning, you know, participation can be helpful in modeling what those future working relationships can look like. Young men and young women's leaders successfully working together and letting the youth see that. And then also when they are planning activities, working on that together, then that can help them see each other as equals and kind of foster those relationships and those skills and being able to collaborate with each other. That's one example, I guess.
Yeah, no, that I think that would be, if you're a young men or young women's leader listening to that, I mean, absolutely, do you need to be thinking carefully about how you're preparing the men and the women for how they're going to interact in the workplace when they're 18 and 19 and 20 and 24 and 5. Like, I really think you can make a good argument that what you do is going to impact their early career on both sides. And in this day and age, it is going to be all mixed gender all the time. And by the time my kids get into the workforce, there are probably only going to be a few occupations that are like male dominated, you know, very few.
Well, and to go off of that too, I was just thinking about how, as adults, how we talk to others about the opposite gender. So for example, like if you're talking to a young man, are your questions about women all about who he's dating or who he likes or vice versa, as opposed to, you know,
like who are your friends? Like,
right.
I mean, the assumption that he can have platonic good friendships with women, that it doesn't always have to be a dating relationship or, you know,
right.
Whatever.
We're not always trying to force that to become a dating relationship. Like,
right.
Oh, well, you guys just seem to spend a ton of time together. Well, you know, have you thought about dating? Well, I mean, it's a valid question, but like relationships that are healthy don't always have to lead down that road. And it's okay if they're just friends, and that's
right.
Healthy.
Definitely. It's almost sometimes concerning to me when, like, when I'm dating men and they don't have any female friends.
Right.
Like, it's almost, it's definitely a red flag to me sometimes. You know, we often, the other thing, too, is we often hear, the stories we hear about men and women working together are always these, like, the man and the woman got in a car together and then, bam, sex, 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 sex. Like, that's immediately what happened. And we've already talked about how, like, there's a lot of things that happen between, like, getting in a car with someone and sex, 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 right? I mean, I've had definitely a lot of relationships where I have not had sex, sex, sex. So, I think one suggestion is really to start sharing more stories. And we've shared several just tonight about where men and women have maintained professional working relationships and they've never had affairs, right? We need to stop using these stories as a way to shame and scare people into not sinning. Like, that is not the way to help people not have affairs. It's not to scare them. It's not to shame them. It's really like, hey, let's talk about how there are so many more examples of healthy, positive, professional working relationships between men and women, and we should, like, cultivate that instead.
I think one thing, too, is, you know, there is, we've already talked about that there's a lot of fear, a lot of sensitivity around this issue. And, you know, within a couple, if this is a conversation that you're having, you know, hopefully you have a marriage where you can have honest conversations about what's going on at work, who you're interacting with on a regular basis, and hopefully you feel like you can be transparent about your work relationships, and that will decrease the fear and increase the trust. I think it's when we don't talk about it that, again, these sort of exceptional stories begin to creep into, you know, what's happening at work. You know, I don't ever hear about what's happening. And when you can talk about, hey, yeah, I met with my boss today and we talked about this and this and this, and, you know, she's really going to help me do this and this with my career, I think that breeds a, like, you know, less fear and more trust. And, you know, hopefully that can help you, you know, not only improve, you know, this particular situation, but also help your marriage, hopefully long term. I don't know if you guys have anything else you want to add to that.
Well, I mean, in any type of relationship, when nothing is said, then there's all kinds of room for assumptions to be made, right? And often we, like, jump to the worst conclusions when there might not be any grounds for that. So I think that's a really good point, Julianne.
The one other thing that I'd written down to talk about was, you know, if you're a guy, you know, and you're still in this, I don't think this is an issue, like, we haven't been persuasive to you in some way on this podcast that, you know, you need to rethink this, or this isn't a problem for me. Like, you know, one thing you can do is what I call, you know, just take a moment to like wear some pink loafers, you know, going off Carolyn Pearson's pink moccasins, right? Is think about it, you know, before, as you take these actions in the workplace and as you think about what your patterns of interaction are in the workplace, you know, flip this around and imagine, you know, imagine that you were, you know, a man working in a female dominated field and, you know, your female colleagues were like, you know, I'm sorry, Bob. I can't go to lunch with you unless I go and find Marianne because, well, that just would be inappropriate, right? And just think about all the conversations you would miss out on. Think about all the networking chances you would miss out on if you were systematically not allowed to develop, you know, just normal working relationships because the women all got together and decided that they had this rule that you were sexually dangerous to their marriage. Like, that's, you know, it just takes a little bit thinking about how that would make you feel, how that would make you, you know, all of a sudden be like, wait a minute, how are they looking at me? Like, how are they looking at my butt when I walk by in the office cubicle? Like, are they, of course, you know, that's just not what's going on.
Or how your feet look in those pink loafers.
Yes, exactly.
Or how they, maybe they have a foot fetish, you know?
Like, that's a really nicely cut suit you have right there, right? You know, just think about, like, I think just flipping that around and thinking about, you know, how would that make you feel and be like, hey, let's just not do this to other people.
Well, and I think Alex does this really nicely in the end of his post. He starts thinking about how he would want his daughter to be treated in the workplace, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important thing to consider, too. Like, how would you want your daughter or your wife to be treated if she was your female coworker? Like, would you want your daughter or your wife to miss out on those opportunities at work just because she's a woman? Would you want the men at work to avoid her because she's a woman? And I would hope that your answer would be no. Right?
Yeah. And even more importantly to me, it's like, do you want to send your daughter or anybody into a workplace where their first, like, you know, the first thing people are thinking about is like their sexual identity, you know, like, you know, and it's no, like, you know, let's assume, you know, Alex has, you know, a very attractive daughter, for example, like, you know what? She is a person first. And she wants to be treated as a professional first, as we all do, right?
Right.
I think that's important. And I do think it's important, by the way, we had to mention that we had reached out to Alex to ask if he wanted to be on the podcast. And there were, you know, some scheduling issues that made that not possible. But in the email exchange, you know, I kind of asked him, like, you know, he said, hey, can you just, make sure that you mention this, right? So I'll just look at this because I think it's important to have authors, you know, we're talking about his post, of course, but his office is that he said, I just want to emphasize one point that he wrote in the post. And this is the point that he made, that an important recognition is that the problem lies with men, not women. It's not women's fault if men feel uncomfortable. And as a result, men treat them differently. It's an issue each of us men have to address. So I think at the end of it, like you said, he had come to this conclusion that, you know, this is an issue that, it's not that women are doing something wrong here. This is something that we men have to deal with.
And so in true LDS style, at the end of every lesson, we have a challenge for everyone. And we hope you'll, you know, take this with you. And, you know, we'll have a recap in next week's lesson. I'm just kidding. about how you did. But if you're an LDS male, our challenge to you is find at least one or two female colleagues who you could include in your professional circle. How could you mentor them and reach out to them? You know, what are the things that you could do to try to include them and get to know them, you know, beyond just a label, but to bring them into your professional circle and hopefully foster that networking, the same networking and the same, you know, connection that you have with your male colleagues. And if you're an LDS female, look for ways to actively engage with LDS men on a professional level. You know, look for ways to, you know, invite them to the things that you're participating in and hopefully engage them. So give them an opportunity to, again, get to know you past a label.
And so What we would love too is to hear, just to go along with our one of our solutions, is to hear about the positive stories that you have working with men, if you're a woman, and if you're a man working with women, you know, trying to increase the narrative about really great professional working relationships between men and women. So if you can do that, we'd love to hear that. So I think that concludes our conversation tonight. So thank you, Alex, for your thought-provoking post and being the stimulus for this conversation tonight. And as always, we invite you to visit aspiringmormonwomen.org and to join our discussion forum on Facebook.
Thanks for listening.